You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by HuntStand. HuntStand is the number one hunting app in the country, and at only $29.99, HuntStand offers a ton of functionality for hunters all over the country. Whether you own your own property or strictly hunt public, you can choose from over a dozen base maps, view property ownership information, 3D mapping, local weather, log your sightings and harvest, as well as use their trail cam management software, and print maps from your hunt areas. Download it today at the Apple App Store or Google Play. HuntStand. Upgrade your arsenal.
The Houndsman XP podcast is fueled by Joy Dog Food. Joy Dog Food has a rich tradition of supporting the Houndsman of America. Founded in 1945, Joy is proud of its history and the relationship it has built with the American Houndsman. And in 76 years, there's never been a recall. Made with 100% American-made high-quality ingredients, Joy Dog Food has one of the highest calorie-dense formulas on the market. For 76 years, this made-in-America product has kept hunting dogs in the field day after day, season after season. And when we say made in America, Joy has a long track record of fighting for American freedoms by being on the front lines against the animal rights movement and their extremist tactics. Joy will fuel your hounds and fight for your freedoms, fueled by Joy. This is the Houndsman XP Podcast.
Good dog, get that burn. Get that burn here.
The original podcast for the complete Houndsman. The podcast that represents our lifestyle of extreme performance.
Get up there! Get him! Yeah! Good boy!
Good boy, Ranger!
Uniting houndsmen across the globe, from east to west, north to south.
You know, if you're going to catch a cat or a lion, you know, you have to have teamwork.
We take you to the wildest places on earth.
Yeah, so how many days a week do you spend out there?
As much as I can, to be honest with you. Anytime that I get, I'm out there.
Join us for every heart-pounding adventure on Houndsman XP.
I'll tell you like I tell everyone else, I'm going to hunt whether you're here or not, so you might as well be here.
On this episode of The Truth on the Houndsman XP Network, we are doing a prequel show. A couple weeks ago, you heard John Strickland and Ashley Oxendine talk about Big Country and some of the winning that he did. We had a lot of requests for a backstory behind that, and in this episode, I sit down with Donnie Walston and Steve Burkholder, and the three of us talk about the beginning of Big Country, where he came from, the breeding behind him, why he is so controversial. We just discuss a lot of things, and we talk about some dogs in his historical past and other great teams of blue ticks and handlers that faced the same kind of scrutiny when they were hot and they were rolling. So this is the backstory. I think you're going to enjoy it. We got it out of order. It was just due to logistic stuff. Josh had the availability to sit down with John and Ashley, and we couldn't get everything pulled together with Steve, Donnie, and I to get the original episode. But you're going to enjoy it. The Old South Dog Box is rocking. It's time to get it open and hunt some Big Country. It's time to dump the box. Southern Hound Hunting Magazine is the most comprehensive magazine that represents your lifestyle as a houndsman. If you can hunt it with a hound, it is being covered in the pages of Southern Hound Hunting Magazine. You also get an in-depth look at the men and women who are engaged in this lifestyle, living it every day to the fullest. From the Rocky Mountains to the Southern Swamps and across the ocean, with articles about our international houndsmen and what they're chasing across the pond. Go to southernhoundhunting.com, get your subscription for $15 a year. Southern Hound Hunting Magazine, promoting the fair chase experience. Have you got your stuff set up?
Mm-hmm.
How's come you got that mic so far away from your face?
Well, I had to take me a drink of whiskey.
Oh, my whiskey.
Yeah, that's right.
You brought whiskey, but you left it in the truck.
Well, hey, I got trained by you, so.
Actually, we'll get everything all adjusted here.
Is that wind going to be a factor, you think?
Makes it authentic.
Is that just me breathing heavy?
It's you breathing heavy. It's authentic. Makes it authentic. Now, Burkholder, are you going to get all wound up where you're going to have to make me get on this volume and stuff to try to keep you straight?
Well, they say this is a truth series, so.
This is definitely the truth. The good thing about this wind is when we do get all wound up, you won't be able to hear the nose breathing and everything else that I always have to edit out.
You tell me where you want the mic at so you don't have to edit near as much.
If I told you where I wanted that mic, wouldn't be able to edit there. We wouldn't be able to publish a podcast, Steve.
Yeah, see this.
No, we've been trying to put this one together for a long time, so we're going to call this the Big Country prequel. The truth, the prequel.
The first half.
And people know you, Burkholder. Steve Burkholder. How long you been competition hunting?
Well, I moved to I moved to the Angola.
Let me help you there, sweetheart.
Yeah, right, there you go.
There, now you can still get your cup to your face
there
and it's still pointed at
yeah,
you.
I wanted to make this high tech stuff, you know what I mean? I'm not quite used to that.
You don't want to spill any of that good bourbon down your shirt there.
That's right.
We just got you hooked up on how to listen to a podcast.
I know. That in itself is kind of a tough deal. But, no, I moved in the Angola, Indiana area in 1990 from Wisconsin. And I believe it was in 91 when I started competing. As a kid growing up, I think I went to a couple water races there at home, you know. But I've probably been following these hounds for, over 40 years. I started, I think, 7, 8 years old when I started with started hunting.
And then we got Donnie Walston to my left.
Thanks for having me on, Chris. I know we've been trying to put this together for quite some time now, and it's, nice for the three of us to be together and be able to do it.
Yeah. Well, Donnie, it took 2 years. I mean, yeah. Chris has been doing this podcast for 2 years, so I'm not sure if they really want a story here or if they just was running out of material and wanted me and you to come,
Well, definitely.
Just hope we can put something together here. It's worth broadcasting and it works out. I have my that could be a little questionable. I don't know.
Well, Donnie, the reason you're the reason why we're sitting here, because of a dog that you had and then all of us got in on it. And let's see if we can recall this story and all have the same version. How did that all come about?
As far as the three of us getting together? Or
well, yeah, I mean, just, whole... how do we want to do this? Do we want to – I think we start with where Big Country came from. And don't be getting a big head, but – it's already big enough. At least you're not wearing that damn Bengals hat tonight. Jeez, oh, Pete. That's
it's not Sunday. I mean,
and they're losers.
I'll break it out Sunday. They're 5-4 right now.
Are they winning?
Calm down.
Winning record this year? That's like no wonder all the Bengals fans are celebrating. That's the first time in a long time.
All I'm going to say on that, I grew up.
You got to be tough to be a Bengals fan. I mean, it's easy to be a Steelers fan, but you got to be tough to hang with the Bengals.
All I'm going to say this year on the whole Bengal bandwagon is I grew up in Wisconsin, and all I can do is refresh your memory, Donnie, on missed field goals.
Oh, man. I was at that game. My sister rolls her ankle as soon as we walk into the stadium, breaks her ankle before we even get to our seats. She's upstairs for three quarters suffering through it, and I wouldn't leave. So I go up there, and she can't even stand. I said, we gotta get some help from security here. We get her out in a wheelchair, and as that debacle's taking place, I'm out in the parking lot listening to, you know, the roaring and cheers in the stadium. I'm missing it all and have to listen to the overtimes on the way home on the radio. So, yeah, what a mess that day was. But anyway, back to Big Country. I'm not sure where to even start at there, but
well, the thing that I think everybody needs to know about you and Blue Ticks is you've always impressed me with the knowledge. You spent your whole life studying ads and books and all kinds of stuff and knowing what you were looking for. And what are some other dogs besides Big Country? You've had several that have gone on to.
Well, I wouldn't say several. I mean, I've raised a lot of blue ticks. I mean, that's always been kind of my breed of choice because that's primarily, you know, where I started as a kid. You know, probably the real first coon dog that I ever got to experience was a direct son out of Harpeth River Joe that my dad was able to purchase from our good friend Kenny Cone.
Yeah.
And I was probably, you know, 12, 13 years old and experienced that hound, and he was super coon treer. I mean, he was a outstanding coon hound. So at an early age, I got to experience some good dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so early on, my expectations were that bar was set pretty high. And I guess a lot of people probably don't really know who I am. You know, I've not been one to go out there and competition hunt. I have dabbled around in a little bit, you know, when I was younger, with no success, primarily because of the dog that I took, I think. But it just my expectations of what a hound should be is what I've been chasing my entire life, and Big Country, you know, met those demands. And I guess I was just lucky enough to, you know, find a couple guys like yourselves that seen the same talent that I did, and I was willing to admit, you know, that I could only do so much. I took the dog as far as I was capable of doing it, you know, and we got to a point where we realized that the two of us, you know, probably got to that point, and that's where Steve come into the picture.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
there's a lot of
I'll tell you.
Probably useless information between A and B there that a lot of people's not going to care about, but you know, the thing is,
I think they do care about it. I think it's a cool story because I've told several people over the years of being in partnerships and different things on different ventures, I mean, besides my marriage, the three of us, I think that was one of the best partnerships I've ever been in.
Well, I'll admit, and I agree with that 100%, you know, and I'll admit that I was extremely reluctant to even go down that road just for that fact right there that 99% of the partnerships that I've seen usually fail. And, you know, I know when we discussed it, your relationship with Steve through the Hoosier Tree Dog Alliance, you know, mm-hmm. you had, you know, a background with Steve and was familiar with him. More so than me, probably. I remember meeting Steve when I was young, probably teenager, maybe younger, at Russell's. I don't know, you know, I'm 40 years old. You just told me you're 48, so we're talking a long time ago, and you wouldn't even remember it. But I remember Russell talking about you when I was a kid and hunting with you a lot. And when me and Chris, I don't know if I ever told you this or not, but when me and Chris talked about it, I immediately called Russell. I'm not going to lie, Steve, and because, you know, I trust Russell with everything, and his opinion means a lot to me. And he told me 100% that's the right guy for what you guys are wanting to do. There won't be anybody better, and that he was 100% right, and it worked out.
Well, going back to Russell, he had a little female many years ago that he hunted that was a good female. I don't remember what he called her.
Bonnie, probably.
Bonnie.
Yep.
And that would have been back when I had my Droop Jr. dog. And, see, Droop Jr. would have been, I would have whelped him in 96. So that would have probably been around 98, 99, 2000. I actually hunted with Russell quite a bit then. And so that would have been, you know, that had been over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So
I remember when Chris, you know, got into Blue Ticks. And at that time, I'm in the middle of building our home. My wife and I were in a little rental house there. My oldest daughter was just born, you know, got a lot of things going on. And Chris texted me out of nowhere, "Hey, I know you've hunted Blue Ticks for a long time." He said, "I just got a pup. You want to get together sometime and go?" And I'm like, "Yeah, anytime, you know." And
yeah.
I told my wife, I said, "This is a little bit odd. I don't know if I'm getting set up here and he's wanting to try to arrest me for something or what." I'm not sure how I feel about this. And of course, you know, we went hunting and hit it off. And, you know, long story short, you got to hunt with a young, wild version of Big Country at that time. And I think you've seen the first night you ever hunted with him, you've seen the potential that was there and the things telling you about.
I didn't like him. That night we hunted up the holler down there.
Excuse me, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't like him. I really didn't. But let me tell you, I was hunting my boondog that night.
Which was a plot.
Mm-hmm.
It was, well, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah. And what is wrong with you? Anyway, but no, I didn't care for him. And then he was young that year. That was the first year that I had Jazz, and we went hunting. And I mean, he had some potential, but as far as he was two, you know, or he wasn't even two yet. He wasn't quite 2 years old yet.
Yeah, I don't, you know, time gets away from me, you know, I don't.
But
yeah, he was young.
But the thing about him was, he did some good stuff. He did stuff. He wasn't afraid to take chances and different things like that. But the way we got together on him to begin with was I had just about burned Jazz up.
Yeah.
I was hunting her too hard, and I knew that she needed a break, and you were trying to build that house, and I went and got him, and you said, "Yeah, I'd like for somebody to hunt him." I went and got him.
He's doing me a favor and doing the dog a favor. Yeah. I mean, it's a win-win for me.
Turned him loose the first night, and he was a different dog than what I had hunted with before. And I was like, "Donnie, this dog is way too good to be sitting behind your barn in Farmer's Retreat."
I remember the text you'd sent me that next morning or maybe that night. I probably still have it saved on my phone that this dog – well, let's see. Let me think about this for a second. I don't want to get it wrong, mm-hmm. But this dog runs a track like a plot, sounds like a freight train, hunts like a walker. If he's got more gas in the tank than what I'm seeing, this sucker deserves to be on the cover of a magazine.
Yeah.
And we knew that. We realized that. Or, you know, it's – he – of all the dogs that I've raised, I mean, he was the epitome of that total package, you know, that I'd been looking for my whole life. It just, you know, timing just wasn't real good for me. And I need to mention that there was a few-month period there that some friends of mine, Ryan and Jeremy Whitaker, mm-hmm. talked me out of him. And, you know, I was
they brought him
a
back.
Weak point. And yeah, those boys give me their word that, you know, if they was at a point they wanted to sell him or whatever, that, you know, I could have him back. And they did that, you know. So they didn't have to, but they did, you know. So a couple good guys there, you know, that had him and got to have a little fun with him. So,
yeah.
I was fortunate to get him back.
So we'll get into all the Big Country stuff, but I think to close out, you know, just to kind of wrap this part of the conversation up, you know, I hunted him there for, I don't know, I made him a night champion and made him a PKC champion, and then.
Well, we did.
Yeah. Huh?
Well, we did.
Yeah. Yeah. Remember that night we were hunting him right up here? The night we won his night champion.
Yeah, that kid just couldn't he couldn't believe what just happened to him.
They had been pitching in on us all night. They'd been, and it was a UKC hunt, and it was like, as soon as he opened his mouth, they had dogs that would cover, and they knew they were there, and they knew they weren't going to be able to hear their own dogs.
So I mean, this was just a matter of just a few minutes at the end of the hunt. You know, it was over. There wasn't but about 10 minutes left when, you know, when all that happened.
Yeah.
It was right at the end.
Yep. He located, and I put him on the card, and you were like, holy crap, I can't believe you treat him like that. And I knew that he was – I knew about where he was at.
And you knew the woods and knew right where he was. And
yeah. We walked in, and he had a coon, and that sealed it up for him. And then
– You had a good night at the Labor Day Classic with him.
Mm-hmm.
I think I put a win on him down at DuPont, you know. And then we went to that – remember that regional qualifier we went to in the middle of, I don't know what it was, July or August. It was 90 degrees and 90% humidity. And
Yep.
Finished him out there.
Is that where he finished?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we both won our cast that night and qualified for the world hunt. And
Yep, that's true.
He was hunting Jazz.
Mm-hmm. And then remember the night we drew each other at Portland? That's before we were partnered up on him, I think.
Yeah, might have been. That was
at the Spring Classic. Yeah, or what they call that Spring Roundup or Spring Classic or something.
I was thinking it was Blue Tick Days, but maybe not.
No, it was a Spring something.
Yeah.
It's the hunt that the BBCHA and BBOA put on together.
The reunion. It was held at Portland one year, I believe.
Was it the reunion?
Yeah, Blue Tick Reunion. I believe they held it at Portland one year.
Yeah.
Around that time frame, probably.
And that was a shootout from the beginning to the end. I had to do a little slick handling to get ahead.
Yeah.
And had to talking one of the other guys out of quitting. Remember that? Remember that kid that was – he was hunting a good dog, too.
That was a nice little walker female, and I thought that – he had pretty well control of the cast, and just a couple bad breaks and mistakes just kind of put him out of it.
He made some bad calls and picked up some minus.
But he really started off on fire, and I was like, oh, man.
Yeah, what is going on? You know. And I think he was down 250 or something, 250 minus. And I said, you know, this is a blue tick hunt, and you're hunting Walker. And he's like, yeah, I think I'm ready to go home anyway. Yeah. And I was like, yes.
Well, I remember he had his son with him, was pretty young, trying to keep up. And, you know, which wasn't a big deal, wasn't a factor.
He ended up staying with us.
He stayed with us and walked the whole time and, you know, commented on, you know, those were probably the two nicest blue ticks he'd ever seen, you know. And,
yeah.
And really ended up having a nice hunt. And I think Jazz, I don't know what she ended up with. It was, I think, over 1,000 or right there. Or, I mean, we treated a bunch of coons that night.
Yep, it was a shootout from beginning to end.
Yeah, I don't think you would have beat me if you had known country so well and been hunting with
I guarantee
you.
That'd be the only way, I promise you on that.
Yeah.
Guarantee you. No. We're not even going to get into the clinics that I have put on in these hills and hollers around here.
And I'm going to miss it tonight.
Oh, man. And then we got to the point where you were busy. I was working, started a new job and working another job, and we knew that he needed to be in bigger stage. And I think part of it is neither one of us really wanted to do that.
Well, I think me and you will both agree, you know, that we're the two oddballs here when it comes to competition hunting. You know, the two of us, I mean, me especially, you know, would rather pleasure hunt, you know, by myself with a good 1 year old, you know.
You like making dogs. You like making dogs.
I that's what I enjoy. You know, that's kind of my thing right now, and that's my lifestyle. And you know, the time that I have, it just kind of really fits where I'm at right now. You know, I'd like to get there someday. You know, maybe when I'm, you know, close to retirement or something, be out there, and hopefully Steve's still out there in the circuit. I can compete against him a little bit, but we'll see. I hope to be there one day, but right now that's where I'm at.
And then here comes Steve Burkholder.
Yeah, the man.
I called you.
The legend.
I called you.
Actually, what really happened is I've been fortunate over the years and hunted some really good blue ticks. Had some that won a bunch. And the last really good female I had was a little female called Gypsy Lady. And when she died, I had went through probably, had made probably 3 or 4 grand nights. And competed a little bit on the you know, as I got older, you know, as you guys know, my work schedule was always tough, so I couldn't go to – I never really cared.
There isn't anybody that's a harder working guy than you, Steve. We know that.
Well, I don't know about that, but I will share this.
You're the only guy I know – Donnie and I were talking about this. You're the only guy we know that will call us and then tell us you're too busy to talk.
Well, that happens sometimes, you know. But you know, as I got older, I enjoyed hunting. I enjoyed hunting a lot of the bigger hunts. And a lot of it wasn't, you know, a lot of the bigger hunts and where the good dogs was at wasn't in UKC. And, mm-hmm. and I wanted to compete on them levels, and we did. We've been very fortunate. But probably about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I actually kind of got frustrated looking for a good one. I mean, obviously, as you guys know, I live in heavy blue tick country up there where I'm at, and just could not find something that had that extra gear or was going to compete with them. You know, in them hunts, you know, once you start hunting some of them hunts and, you know, there's something about going out and drawing one good coon treer, but when you got to beat three good coon treers, that's a little different level. And I'd been looking and actually hunted quite a few walker dogs, but, you know, I started out with blue ticks at 8 years old, and it's always been my heart to hunt a good blue tick. And I remember laying in how country kind of come into the picture for me is I was laying in bed one night. And my wife.
Oh yeah, I forgot about this part of the story.
My wife had been on me for about a year. She wanted me to get a good blue tick, and I said they don't make one like that. I said I've hunted with them all. I've tried them out. I said if I get the right one, I would, but they're just not out there. And she would surf Facebook and look at all these ads and stuff. And she goes, "Hey, I'm gonna get you a pup out of this cross." And I said, "Well, you can for yourself, but I'm not hunting one of them. Why not? Well, I've hunted with all of them behind them, and I'm just not gonna waste my time with it." And I was laying in bed one night, and she come in there, and she goes, "I found a perfect blue tick pup for you." And I said, "Well, I'm not a puppy guy, so I don't want a pup." And she goes, "That's fine. I'll get a pup off this cross if you like it." And she goes, "I'll raise it and get it started, and then you can finish it." And that's when she showed me the ad. You had bred your Jazz female to Big Country. And I looked at that pedigree, and I looked at it, and I kind of set the phone off the side, and I picked it back up. And I started looking at that pedigree, and I said, "You know what? If I was to hunt one, it'd be out of something bred up like that." I said, "Because I've hunted with a lot of them behind them." And unbeknownst to me, that was the end of the conversation. And she called you, and booked a pair of pups. And I forgot about it because I think she was just bred then. And about 2 months later, she says to me, she goes, "Hey," actually she booked one. And then she got to talking to a really good friend of mine, Jason, that as childhood kids, we
Jason
hunted together. Jason Diltz. Yeah, he was wanting, his boy had gotten old enough and was wanting to get him back in it, and she was talking to him at church. And so she called you and booked another pup. And then I didn't even know you was involved with him at that time. I didn't know Donnie was involved with him. And about 2 months later, she said, "Hey, Chris called and said that she had puppies and that we got two females coming." I said, "Chris who?" And she said, "Chris Powell." I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "I know Chris." And that's when we got to talking on it. And I really didn't think any more of it. And then pups come time to be picked up. Of course, you know, she bought the puppies. And, of course, now it's my responsibility to go pick them up. And that's when I met you north of Indy.
At Cabela's. Yep.
And I'll never forget it. I roll in there to get these puppies. And you get there, Chris, and you let them run around. And we're sitting there talking. And I don't know nothing about Big Country. I just knew what he was off of, and I'd hunted with a bunch of them dogs and behind them, and honestly, I was not excited. I tried to get out of it, come down and get them pups, and we got to talking, and right before you left, you said, "Hey, you really need to come down and hunt with these pups, sire." He goes, he's one of them special ones, and I looked right at Chris, and I said, "I've heard that garbage so much the last 8 years, it make me throw up." And he said, "I'll tell you what."
Briar Creek Kennels is your complete hound hunting outfitter. Boots, lights, collars, and tracking equipment. Dog boxes, kennel supplies, collars, clothes, squalors. Whew, they have it all. Briar Creek Kennel is a Garmin and Dogtra dealer. Owner Chris Girth will ensure Briar Creek Kennel customers will get top of the industry customer service. Whether you purchase from their website, or you find them at a major coonhound event, Chris and his staff will share expert knowledge and experience about every product they offer. Chris Girth is a top competitor and breeder of hounds. He knows what gear you need to be successful. Look for Briar Creek Kennels on the web for a complete online store or look at their fully stocked trailer at any major coonhound event. Briar Creek Kennels, offering a hound hunting public generations of excellence. Check out Dogs Are Treed at dogsaretreed.com. Leashes, tie-outs, medical kits, paws are protected, and Dogs Are Hydrated, cutting-edge, high-quality gear for you, the houndsman. Gear designed for houndsmen, by houndsmen, with the highest level of craftsmanship available. Dogs Are Treed is also the exclusive dealer for Houndsman XP podcast logo wear. We're working on our line over there, but we just dropped some new hats at Dogs Are Treed, and you can see them on our page at dogsaretreed.com. And don't forget, at checkout, enter the code HXP 20% off, all capital letters, and you will get 20% off of your entire order. Find them today at Dogs Are Treed at dogsaretreed.com.
We good?
I think so.
Am I, think I we're... on? I don't think I'm on.
How's yeah, come you're not
you.
On? How's
can
come
you hear me?
I can no. hear you. No?
No.
How about now?
I think I hear him. Not unless it's coming through my...
How about now?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, so we cut that out right in the middle of Steve's story because... Actually, the battery's died. So this recorder has this little bar that goes up and down, and the more you talk and the louder you talk, the more the bar works, and I think it ran our batteries out quicker.
Good job, Steve.
Yeah, I knew Chris was going to try to get that in there in the end.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, we met at Cabela's, and you picked up this pup.
I picked up that pup, and I remember you telling me, you said, you really need to check this blue dog out, or you need to check out Big Country. And he goes, I think he's got what it takes to – I think he could compete on a – on a big level. And I said, you know what, Chris, I've heard that so many times over the past 10 years. I said, it's hard for me to imagine that. And you said, hey, you know what, I'll tell you what, why don't you, when you get free, why don't you come down and just go hunting with him? Now, mind you, this would have been right around the December. It was before Christmas.
Mm-hmm. The pups was born early November. They said perfect birthdays.
Yeah, November 1st. Yeah,
it was summer right around.
They had perfect they had birthdays.
Yeah. So it was summer right around the middle of December. I'm thinking, you know, it's maybe a week or two before Christmas, maybe a week before Christmas. And I said, well, let's get the holidays out of the way, and I'll come down there and just hunt anyways. And I thought, you know, they're 4 hours south. I'll go down and hunt a couple of nights when the weather's bad up here. Really not expecting to see a lot because you have to understand where I'm coming from. He hunted plots and just got into blue ticks. So, you know.
Plots is not the only thing I've hunted. I've hunted everything.
Well, I'm just saying. So I had to consider the source a little bit. But anyways.
You made it real clear to us when you come down here. The guys, you know, these are all the dogs I've owned in the past. And you know,
now, Donnie, I didn't go right quite. I didn't quite go into that detail in the beginning.
Well, you did, too.
I knew your credentials.
You did, too. You gave us, like, I'm like the most experienced
now,
person
Chris,
here.
Now, that is not true, okay? That is not true. Honestly, I was coming down here to expect to have a good night, good couple nights, and pleasure
out.
Hunt, hang out. And yeah, I wasn't. And honestly, I'd have been happy with that. And so, and Donnie, I hadn't really known you. I mean, really known you, you know. And I remember coming down and sitting right over there at that kitchen table, and Donnie showed up, and I believe I brought two dogs, and I brought a young male dog that wasn't much, and because I wanted to hunt him, just to hunt him. And I brought Tyler's old Belle female. She was a good coon treer. And I think he was hunting Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you hunted Country, and I think Kenny went with us one night too. Wasn't he hunting a?
I think he did.
Kenny did go along with
us.
He had at the time he had the patch female that I ended up with.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was an all blue hunt.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I threw a Walker dog in the following night just to make sure that. But it was a young doe. But anyways, I remember hunting that night, and
it was not even memorable.
And it was cold out, because you have to understand it was end of January probably.
Yeah, it was in January.
And it was cold, and coons wasn't moving good, and we treat a few coons, but not nothing. It wasn't one of them hunts that you remember. Both nights actually, we hunted. We hunted two nights, and the first night I didn't see a lot, but I did see a motor there. That was kind of impressive. But if you recall, you know, that was in back when we was, you know, it was in kill season, and what I seen is I seen a dog that had a lot of potential, and but man, he was reckless.
You've seen a dog that's been pleasure hunted his whole life,
his whole life,
been, you know, prepared for competition.
Yeah, and you know, I remember one time we knocked a coon out or something, and we pulled him off, and he went back to the same tree, and another time we wasn't that sloppy.
Now listen,
I remember it like it was yesterday, okay? Let's just be honest.
Sure.
Anyways.
Just like I remember putting all the wins on him and forgot that Donnie handled him at all.
I got one.
Hey. But anyways, but you know, we made some split trees, but the coons wasn't moving that good. But I tell you what on the second night that we was hunting, I'll never forget it. And you guys don't even know this, and you're going to throw me under the bus, and I really don't care.
That's why you're here.
Yeah. But we treed two or three coons, and we had made a couple trees, didn't have anything in it, including mine. And Tyler's old bell female had treed down at the bottom of a hill. And
treed slit.
I think she was empty, to be honest with you. And which she didn't do very often.
No.
And I'm telling you, that was a good
job. How old was she when you brought her down there?
She was older then. No, she wasn't that old.
She's six, seven years old.
Yeah,
then,
she wasn't
probably.
That old because, you know, we ended up breeding her to country in the end after that. You know.
I'm sorry,
but,
go ahead.
But anyways.
I won't interrupt you anymore, I promise.
Oh, you're all right. I'm used to it. So you guys was at the top of the hill. And I'd walk down to her, and we'd pulled country off of a den tree and had flipped him back loose. And he kind of come down there past that tree. And I had him on my Garmin. And he kind of come past there probably 15, 20 feet away. And I kind of hollered at him and just, get gone, you know, doing that thing or whatever. And I watched that sucker on my Garmin. And I'm telling you, within a minute or two, he was in there 700 yards, give two ground barks, and come treed. And I knew right then and there that he was going home with me. It didn't matter what it took. It was either going to be a partnership. It was either going to be I'm buying him outright or whatever it was going to be. And I was starting to think to myself, if he can be bought outright, I was trying to figure out who I could call to get enough money rounded up. Because and I never forget when he come treed, he come treed on a mission.
Oh, yeah.
And I got up there to where you guys was at, and Donnie said, well, I'll go on into him and – I said, oh, no. I said, I'm walking in here to him on this tree. And I never forget walking in there to him. And, you know, country, when he'd get in that rhythmic chop, he'd be stretched out on the side of that wood, and that back foot would just bounce off the ground.
Yep.
And that sucker was stretched out. And he had a coon there, and we knocked that one out to him. But I knew from that point that when we got back here to the cabin that I was either going
to
own all of them, part of them, or somehow or other something was going to have to be worked out.
Yeah.
You know.
I think that's the thing that
well, we sat there at that table for a good while.
Yeah,
and
we did.
Hashed things out and, you know. And
a couple hours. I know it was way into the morning.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. And, you know, looking back at that, I think we can all three agree. You know, he just turned 4 years old, and that's what a lot of people don't realize. He just turned, you know. The first couple of years, you know, Donnie, you just kind of pleasure hunted him. And
yeah.
I know you guys hunted him in a few hunts and stuff. But, you know, the dog was by no means. He was just – I know you guys hunted him in kill season. But he wasn't in shape, never really been pushed, never really been dialed in on. And I think that's what we talked about.
He'd never been hauled up and down the road. We knew by watching him hit the gate at 3 o'clock in the morning. I hauled him to Mississippi for the Winter Classic.
Yeah.
And saw what kind of performance we had down there and things like that. But we're talking about pounding him on the road, and that's where you came into it.
I think looking back at that, what we talked about is, you know, I said, you know, we have to look at it this way is in order for a dog to make himself is they have to prove themselves in your backyard and on the road. I mean, that's really what the ultimate dog – dogs are judged by, and as we all know, all of them have good dogs until you put them in them situations. And so we struck a deal that night, and the next day he went home with me, and I remember calling Kim, and I was all excited, and she was kind of quiet on the phone, didn't say much. And I got home and I said, Kim, I said, I don't know what this dog is going to be, but I said, he's probably the best prospect I've had since my old junior dog. And obviously most people know what I thought of him. And she goes, I hope he works out for you. I hope he works out for you. And she goes, what about these guys you're in partnership with? And I said, well, that remains to be seen, but I think we're pretty solid there. And, you know, over the years and dog deals, as you guys know, not all of them work out. That's just the way it is. And I said, I don't know how long this one will work out, but I'm pretty sure both them guys, you can take them for their word. And I remember it was February. It was cold in northern Indiana, not fit to hunt. And I had a treadmill set up in the garage, and I started running them on a treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you the reason why. The first night it got halfway decent up here, I cut him loose in a pretty good-sized section. And I'm just sitting there. I'm not looking at my Garmin. And when I do look at my Garmin, he's halfway through this section. And I get in the truck, and you know, it's mile-by-mile sections up there. And when I get to the other road, he's already a quarter way through the next section. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was
thought
like,
I'm running a coyote dog here.
Well, so anyways, I started running them on a treadmill, and I've never had a dog before this. Probably will never have another one after that. I believe it was in, it was 3 weeks, probably. I just slowly built him up every day to see how far I could push him. But I remember running him 2 hours in the morning, 7 mile an hour on that treadmill every morning and every night. That dog was running 14 miles a day on that treadmill, and at nighttime, he'd come off the end of that treadmill like he was shot out of a cannon.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in and I told Kim, I said, if we can ever generate that into one package to where he puts it, you know, to where he has that kind of heart and puts it all together in the woods, I said, it's going to be unbelievable. And then, of course, the springtime broke and I started hunting him. And he was a coon treer, but he was a little reckless. You know, back then I would cut him loose in a section because he was so amped up, he was in shape. And if them coons wasn't moving, he'd zigzag through that section, and I'd go the other road and send him right back through that same section. Or he'd get on the road and run down the road. You know, if there was a woods half mile down the road, he'd run down that road and then go across. And
Mongo would do the same thing. That's something about those dudes. They want to get through the country, and they're going to take the way to
the easiest way they can. Resistance.
Yeah, and he would.
Like, a road.
And so I would.
Terrible habit.
Yeah, and I would. I got one of my friends that I hunted with some. We'd sit up on the road, and we'd drive around, and he'd sit on one way, and I'd sit it the other way. And when he come to the road, as soon as he'd start coming down it, I would bump him, and he'd go right on across. And we kind of got that broke, but I'll tell you what the downside to that was. For about 6 months, when I went to try to catch him, if he was crossing the road, if he heard that truck coming, he was spinning around going the other way, or if he got across, I mean, he could be 50 yards from me. He wasn't catching him. But I remember hunting him when the weather broke.
Which is something I had taken off of him. I had where you could catch him a little better. Because when you had him, it was like turn him loose and get him off a tree.
Yeah, I got good at just, you know, learning how to apologize and walk up somebody's house with my hat in my hands and knock on a door and start apologizing as soon as somebody come out. You know what I mean?
And I was still working for the state at the time, so I wanted a little better handle.
Because well, you wanted to be able to go home.
The person that didn't get forgiven about being in some place they weren't supposed to be is the game warden. I guarantee
you. Right. Yeah. I wouldn't forgive him either. So
no kidding.
But no, I tell you something on a sideline on that. I remember after John had got him and was hunting him down there one night, I went down there just to kind of a side story on that. And we'll get back to this. Is I'll remember when the first time he blew that whistle and that dog spun around. I mean, going dead away from us, 300 yards, going out toward a main road. And I'm wanting to get in this side-by-side and go flying around there. And John blew that whistle twice, and that dog turned around, come right there, jumped on the tailgate. He gave him that can of Vienna sausages. He licked them all up, licked John in the face, and he took him right back down there where he cut him loose at and sent him in there. And instead of going left this time, he went right. So, but that I never got to that point with him because
– So you get like one cam for right and half a cam for left?
Whatever whatever he does works because I've adopted it now. But anyways
– If somebody would have told me when that – You know, when he was young, that somebody put a handle on him like that, I'd never believe it.
I wouldn't either. John was telling me about it, and he showed me firsthand. But, you know, I started hunting him that spring, and we had a lot of long nights. He had all the talent. He had all the natural ability. I tell you, he had everything. I mean, he had everything. He had the chrome. He had the wheels. He had the mouth. He had the hunt. It was just. Country is one of them that, you know, a lot of people probably don't realize this with him. Country is one of them, when he becomes your buddy, he wants to please you.
Absolutely.
But he's going to push you as far as he can to see what he can get away with. And when he realizes that he can't get away with it, he's all done with it. You know what I mean? And but he always, you know, that was what made it fun to when I started trying to get him right. And I'll never forget, it was probably 3 weeks into that deal. I went hunting with a friend of mine, Tyler Sturry, and he was hunting one of his dogs he was high on, and you know, the bell female that he had, she was a gold champion, and I really wanted him to breed her to country. And he said, well, bring him over. I'll check his oil pressure. And I went over that night, and I'm just going to be honest with you. We had a disaster hunt. I mean, his looked quite a bit better than mine. Mine didn't look – the country didn't look good at all. He treated a couple coons, made a couple mistakes. And Tyler says, I'll never forget it. He says, oh, is this one of them big wonder things that you're going to be doing, you know, that you're going to be hunting the next
Tyler
couple
knows
years?
You pretty yeah. well.
He said, oh, is this – I'll never forget it. He says, is this one of them next great ones that you've got? And so I kept on hunting him, and his female come in heat, and he didn't breed her to country. He bred her to something else. And man, I was so mad at him over that. And anyways, it was about, I said, Tyler, I said, I'm going to tell you, you're going to eat that down the road. And I think it was about a month and a half later, he called me up, and he was wanting somebody to go hunting with him. And I went over there that night and hunted with him. I'll never forget it. Country treated like 8 coons. Went like 8 for 9. Another one was a big den. And I think his had treated a couple coons, made a couple empties. I do know this. He was trying to run him over with the side-by-side at the end of the night. but we laugh about it now, you know. So that was kind of how it started out, you know.
Yeah.
That was when he started putting it all together.
The thing about him that I always liked, people don't get this part because it doesn't get hyped. But he was just fun to be around. People like that dog.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you don't even really get to experience him in the woods, just during the daytime and him tied up out of a hunt.
Oh,
people just
goofy.
He just draws people to him.
And he's got people skills as a dog.
It's incredible. He was
kind of a pain sometimes to have around the house too. You know, a couple years, or I think it was about a year and a half in, you know, we traveled up and down the road and kept him in a motel room. I remember the first time I put him in a motel room, that was a disaster. I had to break him from that. He got used to it. I actually got really used to it.
Oh, he got the name Big Sissy because he's just a big.
But I'd get up in the morning to make coffee, and his kennel, I mean, he could not see me from that kennel. And that dog knew when I got up. He'd sit out there and whine, or even nighttime if I wouldn't go hunting. I would have to go out and you know, say something to him or something, not get on him. He just wanted to know that I knew that he was still around there. So that was a personality of him. But that's what made him, honestly. That's why he was what he was, you know. So, you know, it was
very smart hound, a lot smarter than what he gets credit for. You know,
that's what people – that's another thing people don't understand is the brains that he has. I mean, that dog would know if I – when I – you guys see, it's hard to envision here, but as you walk out to my barn where I keep my feed, when I would clear the end of this outdoor kitchen here, when I got around the – he knew whether I was hunting that night or whether I was coming out to feed. And if I was coming out to hunt that night, just by the way I was acting,
he knew,
and he would be ready to go. And if I was just feeding, then the big dumb idiot was standing on the gate just looking at me.
All sprawled out,
yep,
looking at you. I had 4 of them in my kennel at one time, and that personality's, you know, that's characteristic that I'm seeing a lot in his offspring. Same type of personality. And
Babe,
I mean, they just
– Babe's the same way, same exact way. But you know, I hunted him in that April, and
let's hold off, and I want to talk about what we accomplished with him, the year that you went on your run.
I want
to talk about that, but I want to get back to how Donnie selected this pup, because it wasn't an accident, Donnie. You don't do things by accident. You do things that are intentional. You study pedigrees. So tell us how you ended up with that puppy at your house.
Well, I appreciate that, Chris, but I can't take all the credit for that. You know, Kenny Cohn played a big role in getting these pups from Robert Shelton. And at the time, Bo Cephas was, you know, there was some good dogs out of Bo Cephas. And for a couple generations there, Bo Cephas, his sire, Bodacious, and some females, you know, throughout that pedigree had some pretty good success in competition. The Sadie female, Marks, was, you know, very well known amongst the blue tick mm-hmm. enthusiasts. So a lot of good dogs
How
there.
Do you pronounce his last name?
Vandeventer. That may be right. It may be wrong.
How do you pronounce it, Steve?
Vandeventer or Vandeventer or whatever.
Vandeventer.
I call him Mark, but I'll tell you one thing.
Mark V.
I'll tell you one thing about Mark. He's had some good dogs, and he's always hunted a good female.
Yeah, he loves females. But I had to give a lot of credit to Kenny. And Kenny was one of those guys I met when I was a young kid, and he always hunted blue ticks. So a lot of that transpired through him. But, you know, we had a lot of conversations, and, you know, I'd had a kind of a bad run of luck there with blue ticks. I had a nice young dog, you know, come up missing out of my kennel there at my old house that I was really, really happy with, and went through a string of some more pups and that, and just couldn't find, you know, just couldn't come up with another decent blue tick, you know, that I was pleased with. And I told Kenny, he asked me if I'd be willing to raise these pups, if he could get a pair of them out of this cross, if I'd raise them, start them. I said, yeah, I said, that sounds good, Kenny, you know, whatever you want to do, I don't care, you know. I said, but this is probably going to be some of the last blue ticks I think I'm going to raise. I'm going to maybe try some walkers if these don't work out. So, you know, pups show up there at my house. Kenny meets Robert down at Tell City at one of them hunts and brings them there. And I remember, I mean, he opened the dog box there, and this pup, Country, walks out on the tailgate, big, you know, he's probably 12 weeks old, you know, tall, slick as a mole, got slobber hanging all out of his mouth, he's, you know, and the other pup had a curled tail and was black-headed and smaller. So Kenny liked him. He liked the smaller pup, and I immediately, as soon as I seen Country, I knew that was the pup I wanted. And I started them, and both of them really started naturally, really easy, and both of them good, balanced, you know, they run track really well as young pups, and naturally wanted to tree, and, you know, they've just outstanding pups, easy starters. And Kenny had some bad luck there. His father had some bad health that year, and Kenny just wasn't in the mood for a 10-month-old, you know, young dog, you know. So I sold him to Derek Hyatt, and I believe he lives in Nebraska. Friends of Robert Shelton and that group of guys out there, and they still own a dog, called him Curly. Yep. Good dog. They had some good luck with him in competition. So it was a really good cross. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, but Country come from a cross of coon dogs. I
Face
mean, the whole
off,
litter.
Face would have been a littermate.
Littermate sister, and Derek owns that female too.
And I remember them guys, when I first started hunting Country, talked about Face, and Wes Hamilton, all them guys said that's probably, you know, they – That was the dog they was talking about. And that was a littermate sister to him.
Yeah, and Robert had a female he called Lottie, that his grandson titled out, and you know, so that was a good cross that produced a litter of coon dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know,
did I answer the question, or I'm not sure where I was even
going. No, yeah, the question was how do you end up with him, and that's where he came from. But you knew. The thing is, though, I mean, if you look at his pedigree, what are some of the
– Well, going back to that, Kenny and I had many conversations about some of the breeding and that, and most of the dogs that I would acquire or get, you know, that I would fool with, you know, come from Kenny or recommendations from him, and I would pay attention, you know, on the message boards, or, you know, it was kind of before the whole Facebook scene and all that kind of, you know, blew up, but – you know, in the reproducers list, and pay attention to who's doing what in the hunts and that, and just, you know, that kind of information I can retain. I can't tell you, you know, what I did yesterday, but a lot of that stuff I can remember. It's kind of like the radio game of music. Nobody wants to even come close to challenging me when we're riding in a truck and listening to music. I mean, I can't be beat. And some of this coon hound information is the same way. It's relevant information. It's useless, but I can remember it for whatever reason. So I was always good at that. But, you know, we knew those dogs primarily. I'd know
can
experience
you
with them.
Can you sing too, or you just like music?
Merle Haggard's right in my wheelhouse.
Is that right?
Me on a karaoke machine.
Me and you get along just fine.
No. But those dogs I had no experience with, other than that there was success there, that there was a string of dogs there, that the bit female of Richie's on his bottom side is one of the only platinum champion blue tick females. And then, you know, the dogs that got in the finals of the world hunt. So we knew there was something there. And thought, let's try it, you know. But they was primarily, you know, out west, you know, Wesley Martin and them guys that had Bodacious and the Bo Cephas dog, Texas, Oklahoma, and that neck of the woods. I never experienced any of them, never been around any of them.
Well, you know, I tell you, when you showed me Country's pedigree, because the first time I really seen the pedigree was when Kim had showed me the litter of that, but I didn't see his extended pedigree. But, you know, I've been fortunate over the years, been in a position where I've been able to travel pretty much all over the United States. I remember when I was hunting my junior dog, I believe I hunted him in 18 different states. And, you know, I had a lot of knowledge of the dogs behind him because I got to hunt with – I was very fortunate and got to hunt with a lot of them. You know, the old sugar female that Joe Remmer hunted for Warren Hasser, you know, that was a coon. I mean, I competed against her. I mean, and she when I drew him out, she was a dog to beat because she was just a good, solid, you know, coon
that,
trigger.
That would have been Mark's Sadie's mother, yeah, that was bred to Rambo, too.
Exactly.
One of the good
and
crosses
I remember,
on Rambo, too.
I remember being on a cast when Lonnie Smiley had Rambo, too, up at the Ashland Spring Hunt, and I remember seeing him go, and I hunted with Sadie, and that little, you know, bit female. I mean, to me, I mean, in the blue tick world, I mean, I just say it how it is. The bit female is one of the top three, if not the best blue tick female to ever draw bread. That's just my opinion. A Frog Creek Whitey, you know, I hunted with him and hunted with Bodacious one night. You know, Bodacious, he would just slide through that country like one should, you know. And the dot female that Daniel Smith hunted, you know, that was just a good, solid country. So, you know, looking at that, you know, Echo 2, I remember long time ago, I think it was Boaz, Alabama or somewhere, drawing Echo 2 out. I was spectating a cast, and you know, them dogs all had one common theme. They was coon treaters. No matter where you hunted with them, they treat coons. And they was awful good about having that coon when you mm-hmm. got there. And so for me, you know, I honestly, hey, obviously, as you, all of us know, none of us can really take any credit for, you know, there was a lot of guys that bred good dogs to good dogs, and what a lot of people don't realize, country's no accident.
Right.
There was a lot of good guys.
Crosses are,
you know, Robert Shelton,
all throughout his
three, four generations of females, you know, they good females, you know.
I think people, you know, the smart people out there that, you know, are blue tick enthusiasts and, you know, are interested in competing at the, you know, that level and chasing these world titles, you know, if they pay attention and pay attention to some of these good crosses on him. There's a young dog, you know, down south. I'm not going to name any names for warrant any unwanted attention to them guys, but out of a really good cross, and an 18-month-old pup down there just, you know, lights out right now, and he's out of a really good cross that has good litter mates. If people pay attention to those crosses and utilize those dogs in the future moving forward and breed the good dogs out of these good crosses, I think that he can potentially help this breed. It's not going to happen overnight, we know that.
Let's talk about that.
Let me
part.
pump the brakes a little bit.
Yeah, just pump them just a little bit, because I want to cover. Nobody knows about the run that Steve went on with him. Yeah,
that's worth talking about.
In, what was that, 19? 18?
17.
Was it 17?
17 is
no,
when.
What,
yeah,
was it?
It's 17.
Donnie knows.
Man, I you know, honestly, I don't know. I mean, it could be. You would know. I just know.
17.
I know it was in April.
You won your first cast somewhere around April, May.
It was
black and tan days.
No, it was actually I mean, and a lot of people don't know this. I put Country in 8 straight hunts in April of that year. I got him in I believe it was January, whatever, February, sometime around that time frame. Hunted him, and I put him in 8 straight casts and lost every one of them. And it was just our hunts around the house.
That's because you're a poor handler.
No, it wasn't. Hey, but I, you could see, and
we remember that Donnie and I were talking.
He was just getting his feet right of competition, learning the ropes, and
no, but you know, it was $30 hunts, and there was some things that we needed to get right with him, and you know, it wasn't worth for me to win $72 when I knew the potential there, and he, it wasn't that he did a lot of things. It was just little things that he would do. And then, you know, for me, if it was 15 minutes left to go on the hunt, the $72 didn't mean that much to me because I knew the potential behind it. And I vividly remember it. I was hunting in Michigan, and Brandon and Rebecca Kosselman at their club up there. and this was the last cast I lost with him before I won one. We had cut them in there, and he just slid through there and treated coon, I mean, just like that, and flipped him back off of that. And Brandon's female had got treed behind us, and we went to her, and Country and another dog got treed right to the right of her, which leash locked everything. And we went to Brandon, the dog, she had a coon. We went over to them, they had a coon, and we walk them a minute right back to where he treed that first coon. Now, we're about 100 yards from that tree, and we cut him loose, and he goes right down there and just drills that tree. And I got mad, and I went down there, and I said, you guys can scratch me out of this hunt or do whatever, but I said, this will be the last cast, you know, that this is going to happen. And he wasn't bad for that. I'd hunt around the house, pleasure hunt him. He would never go back to the same tree. And I went down there and got him off that tree, and we had a come-to-Jesus readjustment period. And when I cut him off of that, I remember it vividly. He treed three more coons, just pow, pow, pow. And but I was out of the hunt, but I kept turning him loose. And when I got back to the truck the next night, I think it was Wyatt or one of them hunts right around the club had a hunt, and it was April the 27th or 28th. I put him in that hunt, and, I mean, he absolutely just dominated it. And that was the first cast that he'd won for that year, competition year. And from that point to September the 30th, I think he won somewhere around.
He made gold champion.
Well, he made I know in the open hunts, he won right around $3,000 or $3,100 state money. And we never hunted him, if you guys recall. We never hunted him, really. We come down to the Labor Day Classic, hunted one night.
We decided to pull him, get him fresh, get his legs back under him, and save him for the world hunt. And that Labor Day Classic, I mean, is, you know,
yeah,
the
that
week
was,
of
that
Labor
was,
Day.
So. That was, and so we never really – I think I hunted him in two or three hunts in September.
Is that the year I ran with him at Labor Day Classic?
No, this would have been after the fact.
Okay. Did you hunt him at Labor Day Classic?
I hunted him one night down there.
Okay.
We knew if we could get in two or three nights, that we possibly could have won the state race.
Well, I'll tell you exactly.
It didn't work out.
I'll tell you exactly what happened, okay?
It's about time you came clean.
And we went there. I'll be honest with you. We went there and hunted. And remember, I wanted to guide. If you really want to know the truth, I wanted to guide and come down here.
That's it.
And have you guide me. And PKC wouldn't let me guide. They said, you know, since you wasn't hunting the dog, I said, if I'd have known that, I'd have put you down as a handler.
Right.
And I had to go over and hunt some other piece of property there that somebody else was guiding to it from Kentucky. And honestly, I got up the next morning, and I told you guys, I said, I'm headed back home. I said, you know what, because you know, guys know how country hunted and stuff. And here we had an opportunity to literally drive an hour from there and hunt down here.
It takes
you know,
1 hour
you know,
to get there.
You know, and hunt down here where he's used to or whatever. And I went home, and that. But he was wore down a little bit. But you know, backing up to that year, in the month of May of that year, he won a truck. He won a truck ticket.
Twice.
This is the run I was wanting to talk about.
But with that, a lot of people don't realize, that was the year that Blue Tick Days was in Bellevue. And we won the high dog of the month that, but along the way, we took the weekend off and went and won Blue Tick Days with
him. That's absolutely right.
Won King of Hunt at Blue Tick Days that year.
That was right around the same time my youngest daughter was born. That's why I wasn't there.
Yep. And then.
Well, we need to put the wheels back on this thing. You're getting too scattered out here.
No, I'm.
Did we skip something? Because
no, he when I started hunting him, I hunted him in that May when he started out. He won High Dog of the Month, and then he won Blue Tick Day. We took the weekend off. He won Blue Tick Days. And, you know, back then they didn't have the $100 legacy hunts. You know, a lot of these was in the $30 and $50 hunts, you know, and I went to Black and Tan Days that year.
Tri-State Jamboree.
The Tri-State Jamboree was actually in May. Got in three of the four nights there. And then Blue Tick Days was the following weekend, and we took him to Blue Tick Days, won Blue Tick Days. And then at the end of the month was Black and Tan Days, and that was back when they did double headers. And I hunted them all every night, double headers. And Saturday night early, he won his cast, and we felt like we had enough money to win to get a truck ticket. He ended up winning it overall. And then the same year they had the Michigan Summer Madness in that August, and he won. I think he got in four out of the six nights there. And he ended up winning high. He won the high dog of the month for won more money than any dog in the open hunts in August as well.
So that year, we led the national race 2 months, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah, he won the dog of the month or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. where they two different months where he won. I don't know, 1 month he won 1,100 or 1,200, and then in August he won 1,200 or 1,300, something like that. You have to go back and look,
yep.
you know.
Yep.
You know, and then obviously the hunts around the house. And I'll tell you something, to debunk the theory that a lot of people have the myth that, you know, you can win these hunts without plus points and all that. You know, that year, in all the casts that he was in that he won one cast with circle points. It was in July, and we walked into a big leafy tree and couldn't find it. Other than that, every cast that he won, he had plus points, you know. And, you know, that was the thing with him. I remember being in a cast one night, and I'm not going to mention no names, but they was talking.
This is the truth. You can mention all the names you want.
We was sitting around there, and people was talking about how hard he would go. And
just call him out one-on-one.
Country would, but I tell you something that a lot of people don't realize about him in hunts. That dog would take, and if there was coons around you to tree, he'd tree them. 2, 3, 4 at a crab. I remember one night, our hunt at out of our club, a real good friend of mine that's nicknamed Smokey, Carlisle Miller, was in the cast hunting a little female called Crazy. And we scored on 7 or 8 coon on our hunt. And and country treed 4 of them. And they treed one coon right out of the truck together. And then he treed 3 more singles, just bang, bang, bang. And we never got over 600 yards from the truck. And but other dogs was treeing coons too, you know. And
I'm telling you what, man, that dog, when you took him out of the truck, he knew where he needed to go. And what he need, he
his nose was in the wind as soon as you got him out of the box, and
it's
he
like
knew
he could
which
count.
Direction he wanted to go. That myth of, you know, everybody knows, you know, he's got a big motor. You know, it's not a secret, you know, but a lot of people associate that with the dog being a hot nosed dog putting coons up bushes, and that's not him. That's not
you
how
could
he
lead
is.
Him. You could lead him past 3 coons walking deep to cut him loose somewhere. And he'll go tree the coon in front of you, and he'll tree all 3 behind you.
Well, you know,
it was the craziest.
Exactly.
He's the first dog that I – probably the only dog that I'll ever hunt that I've said this to a couple of people, and they thought I was goofy. But that dog had a couple of things that a lot of dogs don't. He would hunt every season different. In the summertime, you could take that dog and cut him in big timber, and he was going to find an edge, and you would never find him in big timber the rest of the night. And in the wintertime, you could line 4 dogs up and racehorse them down a lane beside the edge of a woods. And when he hit the edge of that woods, 50, 60 yards, he was cutting through that timber. He knew.
Top-shelf hounds know where to look for a coon at different times of year. There's no question about that. And he perfected that up there, especially where you're at.
Well, he did.
Adjusted.
He did it everywhere. You know, before I hunted him, you would hear the term, or even for me, this is what I thought. If you got in a cast and you only scored on one coon, and it was kind of luck. But when you're hunting one that you win 80% of them casts, that's the only coon scored. It changed my thinking. You know, some dogs just have that knack of figuring out where that coon is. They have that knack of figuring out where to go to find them. You know, and you know, I remember CHKC World when he made the final three, that late round cast. I was beat. I mean, I was beat all night.
I remember our conversation the next morning.
We had cut them dogs loose. This was after Ashley owned him. We'd cut them dogs loose, and I know Topper was in the cast, and I don't remember the other two dogs, but I remember Topper and Bobby Burt, or no, Zach was hunting him.
Topper's a good one.
He's a real good one. I mean, that dog, I mean, them coon treers win because they tree coons, but we put a coon in the ground. And as you guys know, country got squirrely in the ground. And the round before that, he had treed a coon in the ground. We walk literally after the hunt is over. We walk a mile to him, and he's got a coon in a bulldozer pile. And we walk in there, and when I handle him out of there, which I can't even, and I have to have this coon to win. When I handle him out of the ground, that coon is about 2 foot in front of him. Now, the guy that's in the cast, that's leading the cast, knows it's over when we get to that bulldoze pile. Because, I mean, he's in a bulldoze pile. I mean, a big one. And we get in there, and I pull him out, and that coon is 3 foot in front of him. So, I mean, I thought to myself, I mean, what? That's luck. And then we go to the late round. This is the hunt to get in the final three. And we walk in there, and they're in the ground. And in country, I don't tree him because I know it's not right. And I'll never forget, I'm struck for a quarter. I don't tree him in. And he's coming in and out of the ground over there. And these dogs, a couple of them have grabbed a slick tree right beside there. And Topper gets minus 100 and 100. And a little female's not there. She's struck for 50. And she's gone. And I can't tree country now. You know what I mean? Here I am caught. Now what do I do? And they pull them dogs and flip them back loose. And he stays and monkeys around on the ground over there for probably 5-10 minutes. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. But about like that, he comes right past us. I get pumped a quarter on strike. And everything is going to be struck for a quarter. Now the little female that struck for 50 and she's treed for 100. We go to her. She's got a coon. Late round. We're in Tennessee, and you, as you know down there, that's tough to overcome. And I watch him on my Garmin going, I mean, he's gone. I lose signal on him about a half a mile in there, and Topper blows way through there and gets treed. Struck for a quarter, treed for 100. I'll never forget it. And we go to him, and he's got a coon. And he pulls him off of there. Now the female that struck for 50 and treed for 100 is treed again. And the other boy has withdrew at this point in time because I think his dog come back to us or something, but he's out of it. And the little female, she's way through there, back not too far from where she's treed us for his coon at, and she's treed. And I asked the judge about putting a stationary on her, and he says, I'm not going to put the stationary on her because she's so far in there, but we'll walk that way.
We're going to have to condense this a little bit for time's sake. So.
Okay. So anyways, make a long story short, Topper gets treed again, walking straight away from her. Now, up to this point, I'm not even struck in. We're three quarters. We're probably got 35, 40 minutes left to go in this hunt. And I pick him up on my Garmin. It shows him and he's treeing, but I can't hear him. And we go to Topper, and when we get about 200 yards from Topper, you can hear him treeing behind him. And I strike him and tree him. We go to Topper. He's got another coon. We go down the country, and he's treed behind this trailer park. And he's got a coon.
No lie. Oh, my gosh. I could tell a story about that.
And he's treed behind his trailer park. And now, mind you, when I pull him off of there, there's like 5 or 6 minutes left to go in the hunt. And I can't turn him back loose because we have to hear this female. Topper's not struck. But Topper has to have a coon. He has to have another coon to win. And I'll never forget, we walked 200 yards back out to this blacktop road, and we're walking down the blacktop road to walk back to where we heard this female at. And I know our run is over. And I'll never forget it. Zach says, hey, can we stop and listen? And when we stop and listen, as far as you can hear Topper treed. He strikes and trees Topper, and the judge says, cut him. And when I cut him loose, there ain't 3 minutes and 30 seconds, maybe 4 minutes left to go in the hunt max. And he runs right down the middle of that blacktop road, goes about 50 feet, and spins around and comes running right back between us, right down the middle of the blacktop road, and is gone. And he goes back there, and, of course, the minute's up on Topper. There's like 2 minutes left to go in the hunt, 1 minute. And he just falls treed right back to where he treed that coon at. And I zoom my Garmin way out. I strike him and tree him.
You knew he wasn't on the same tree.
I knew he wasn't on the same tree.
I remember talking about it the next day.
And I'll never forget it.
Telling you, this is it, Steve. You're going to do. You guys are going to pull this off. It's meant to be.
Hey, I strike and tree him. And they send Zach. So they said, hey, since we're right here, hunt's over. Now the guy that struck for 50 and 100, now he's trying everything in the world he can do to try to hear his female, but she's a mile and a half the other way. And he could have treed her for an hour in that hunt and didn't. And hunt runs out, and the judge says, I'm going to score him because if he's got a coon, you know, obviously Topper can't win. And I remember walking in there, and it was right behind this trailer court, and he was treed, literally. We stepped it off. He was literally treed 15 feet over from where he treed that coon at. And I showed him the coon that he treed, and he had another coon there, and that's what. And, wow. he knew that coon was there.
Yep.
I'm telling you, he could just count. That's
he
what he
knew
was.
He
you
knew he could keep it. Hey, before we get to the final part, I'm going to ask you guys a pretty good zinger question here, but I'm going to share my story about the trailer park thing. You remember that night that I was hunting him? It was Christmas time, And I sent you that text.
How's
it going? And I said, I think he's just taking a tour through the neighborhood looking at Christmas lights. It was right at Christmas time. That sucker went through yards and everything else out here in this neighborhood that had all these blow-up things in their yard, those Christmas decorations that have the fans and they blow up. I swear, I think that dog was doing the Christmas
light. Sightseeing. He just out joyriding.
He was on the Christmas light tour. Oh, man, that dog was entertaining to hunt. Yeah. So, all right, here's a zinger. Why is he so controversial in the blue tick breed? Amongst blue tick breeders and blue tick fanciers, why?
That's a tough one. I mean, Steve is probably going to be able to answer that better than me. He's been around the blue tick world longer than I have.
That's a good question, and I think it brings us to, our conversation. Obviously our conversation that we had, obviously selling that dog was going to be the toughest thing that any of the three of us done. And, we talked about it. And, hey, being around the blue tick breed all my life, I knew, and this is just the way it is, I knew that dog, because the way he was bred, had an amazing opportunity, what he could do in the stud pen. But because of what we're going to talk about here, I think we all three knew deep down inside that if we owned him, they was probably not going to breed to him because of the, unfortunately, this is just the way it is, and I'm just going to say it the way I see it. There's a lot of people within the breed that are scared to death that somebody else is going to get recognition. That's just the way it is. And, going back to that part of it, we all three felt when we sold him that if he got into somebody that was not like a typical –
remember this conversation.
I remember you guys, because I know you guys was dumbfounded when I told you guys that when Wes Hamilton put the whole deal together on Ashley buying him, I said, he's obviously, that point in time before they got him, he'd proved that he could win. He was already making a name for himself in the competition world. And it wasn't by us sharing that with him. It was we had the ability where we put him in enough big hunts where people from – away from the breed started seeing what he was capable of, because when you judge
100% feel like we did it the right way and let the dog advertise himself.
Well, when you have guy, this is, I've always shared this, the great dogs from the past was revered by people from all breeds, and that's what he was doing. There was a lot of guys that knew what Coon Dogs was, and we never had to brag on the dog. The dog bragged on himself. It was, and believe me, I hunted in them hunts, and I watched it unfold firsthand. But when guys would hunt with him one or two nights in them casts and stuff, and they was telling their buddies and about him, and we just knew that the dog had a amazing opportunity what he could do in the stud pen, because hey guys, you can't deny what his breeding.
Well, part of that too was we were getting those calls, and I think I eventually started kicking them over to you, Donnie, because I didn't want to deal with it, but then you try to kick them back to me. I mean, everybody, the expectations are so low,
but
that is my take. Is the expectations are so low for what can truly be great. And maybe every person that turns a blue tick loose will stop listening to this podcast after this episode, but that's the way it's going to be, because this is the truth. A couple weeks ago, there was a post put on Facebook about the historical reproducers list, the current list. My Jazz female is on that list.
Yeah.
And she's got she's got four pups that have put her at number five on the list. But so the expectations are so low. But when you start putting him out there on those stages of with people that have won, I mean, what's Halftime Ruby won? Has she won 200?
200. I mean, total with the
220.
Well, with total with the invitation and stuff, she's won over $300,000.
Yeah, $300,000. So these people know. And she's not a blue tick, and these people know what it's going to take to win. And they were the ones that were saying, when you walk into a major event, they're like, "Did you guys bring country? Yes. Okay. They knew we were there every time.
Well, there's a lot.
When you have, you know, when Wes and Brett decided to breed to him, I thought that was, I mean, that's a statement right there. And, for you know, when you have Josh Michaelis and Jed Finley saying he's one of the best dogs they've ever seen turn loose, John Strickland saying he's probably better than Bad Habit, you know, those type of things hold a lot of water with me.
Well,
and for the controversy that surrounds him, and it's primarily, it seems like, you know, well, a lot of that comes from blue tick people.
Well,
and
here's what I'm going to share with you.
But I'm like Chris. I think that my opinion, you know, and it's not a knock on blue tick enthusiasts, the guys that enjoy these blue tick coon hounds, you know, because I fall into this category right now. You know, I think that the majority of those guys are just what I would consider hobbyists of coon hunting, you know, and I'm that way right now. You know, I'm not even close to being in a stage where I'm hunting enough to be able to prepare a dog for competition, serious competition. And I think a lot of blue tick people are that way. You know, their highlight of the year is going to blue tick days and, you know, saying, well, we got 2 weeks before, you know, the hunt, we need to start hunting a little bit and go to blue tick days. And that's it. You know, my recommendation to these guys, if they, you know, if you think you got that dog tied up behind the shed back here, go to the open events in your state, enter those events, and try to lead the nation 2 times in a year
month.
And get a truck ticket.
Yeah,
or try to win the breed race, or try to, you know, compete in your state race. Everybody can afford to go to them hunts. If you can afford to go to the UKC hunts at your local club, you can go to them hunts. You don't have to go to a $6,500 or a $2,500 Pro Classic or, you know, whatever. Just start there and see if you really truly got something that can compete.
Well, 2 things, and we get in these debates all the time. The first thing, to kind of answer your question, why controversial, Tom Brady, as much as I hate to admit it, is as good of a quarterback that's ever threw the ball. And unless he was a New England's Patriots fan, it was hard to root for him.
Yeah, that's
right. You
know
what I mean? Michael Jordan.
No, it wasn't. I love sports.
I understand.
And I don't like New England Patriots, but Tom Brady's the best to ever play the game. And I can recognize that and appreciate that.
But let me deliberate a little
bit. I'm not going to get on social media and message forums and bash Tom Brady and say he's a worthless piece of crap that throws nothing but interceptions every game, like what they're doing in the country, because –
Let me finish on that side of it. So,
sorry.
So naturally, okay. Let me finish. So obviously, Tom Brady is going to probably get ridiculed or criticized on everything that he does, good or bad. Period. I mean, they're going to judge him by the highest esteem because he's revered as one of the best. You know, Michael Jordan when he played for the Bulls. You know, when you become a winner, you're going to get critiqued at everything that you do because you're considered one of the elite.
I see where you're going
you see
with
what
this
I'm
now,
saying?
And I'm sorry for jumping
and,
on you.
And so,
wow, that was vicious.
So when you get something like that, it comes with the territory. You're going to get critiqued and criticized, and that's okay. You know, the reason they was good is because that, you know, they was able to handle that side of it. And back to your original question, why is it controversial? Because And to debunk your theory on the fact of –
oh, he's challenging you now.
No, to where people say, the myth of the behind the barnyard door dog or whatever you want to call it.
Oh, you're going with that. I'm tracking now.
Here's what I'm going to share with you. Here's what I truly believe. Everybody that has a good one has an opportunity to hunt in these hunts because in the day and age and the era that we live in, there's enough guys out there right now that are looking for a dog that they can take to these hunts. So when they tell me that they have, if you truly have one of them, okay, yeah, you may have to partner up with someone, but you can't bring to me and say, you know, if I had the opportunity to go hunt that $2,500 hunt, oh, you know, Blue over here would have the same, or any breed
what
would
you're
have
saying,
the same opportunity.
Yeah,
the opportunity is there.
You're not going to let me talk.
Good dogs find a way to get in people's hands.
You lay this out better than anybody I've ever seen, Steve. Because you always hear, oh, they got to, once you get that money back in them, then that's when they, it's like it wasn't real. Like their ability wasn't real. Like their talent wasn't real until they got money behind them. But you always counter with, the good ones pay for themselves.
The good ones pay for themselves. The great ones make money. And the great ones find themselves in the right people's hands, and they're given that opportunity to compete on the big stage. And for anybody to sit here and say that I just didn't have the opportunity, you have the opportunity. Every single person, especially in the era that we're living in now, if you have one that can compete at that level, there is people waiting right now. I can put you in touch with them. That are looking for one if you think, and they'll cut you in on it. It's not like they're going to take your dog from you or whatever.
Exactly.
They will cut you in on it, and most of the time will let you even handle it.
Yeah.
But I got news for you. At $2,500 a crack or $6,500 a crack, you're going to get your opportunity, but it changes when you get into them style of hunts because, believe me, I've hunted in a bunch of them. And you're not, you don't have to beat one. You have to beat three. And there's number one, there's good dogs there, and you got to have a coon trier to win. Okay, and we've seen it in the past, just in the past year. People get on there and brag about how good, and they get their opportunity. And so as far as that side of it goes, the good dogs get in the right people's hands. They get the opportunity. You know, face it, 30% of these guys that go to these hunts win. The other 70% lose. That's just the way it is. And so, you know, on the controversy side, And this is just me. This is just my opinion. And we talked about it. We all three knew, you know, we all felt that Country had an opportunity. Once he proved that he can win on the big stage and the way that he did it, we all felt like he had the opportunity to reproduce. And obviously for me, that becomes because of the pedigree behind him, the dogs behind him. They was coon treaters. And they
we felt like the chances that he could reproduce were pretty good. But the jury was out. We didn't know for sure.
We didn't know.
We've seen a couple, you know, out of a couple of those earlier crosses, that, you know, on Jazz. And, you know,
but here's what I did know.
We was suspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I didn't know. I knew that if he stayed in our hands on that side of it, and we talked about it, because it was pretty tough when Ashley come to us, Wes Hamilton put us in that. I remember us talking about it. And we just knew that if he stayed in our hands, that he wasn't going to get bred to the he was going to get bred to the off-colored females, but he wasn't going to get bred to the blue-tick females if we owned him, because we're blue-tick fanciers. And we talked about it, and you can see what happened, guys. Proof's in the pudding. You know, people started breeding to him because, obviously, Ashley Oxendine John Strickland aren't blue-tick fanciers. I mean, all they want to do is hunt a good dog.
The thing is, Steve, people would call me, and they'd be like, oh, I got a good one. I got a good female. And we were trying to be smart about this and not just back anything up to him and put the statistics and the odds in our favor that he was going to be a good reproducer. So when people would call and say, I got the best female you ever saw, it's like, bring her.
Yeah.
We want to see her.
And you know how many times anybody showed up with those females?
Zero.
None.
But you know –
But we had a little bit different, probably, mindset. You mm-hmm. know, we wanted you to still be able to hunt that dog, you know. But at the same time, you know, if a good female, you know, that we knew firsthand was a good coon tree and female, we wanted to breed them females. Yep. It wasn't that we didn't want to allow the public to use him. It's just that, in my opinion,
we had different goals at that point in his life.
Yeah. People are breeding them blue ticks all the time, and in my opinion, there's probably too many of them dogs getting bred, you know, and I didn't see any reason why he needed to breed bred until we knew 100% he's worth breeding to.
Because right. We were collecting him. You'd had him collected a couple times. We were breeding him to a couple, trying to preserve some of that. But just this random – and we advertise he's not up for public stud.
Right.
And that might have rubbed people the wrong way, maybe. I don't know, because that's probably not typical of how guys are within their blue tick. The guys that have these dogs, you know, they don't care. You know, they make them a grand night, you know, whatever, and compete with them a little bit, and they're open to the public. You know, breed these dogs.
As you guys know, it's hard to hunt one in these hunts up and down the road and breed them all the time. And, you know, honestly, I mean – If you really, you know, to really get down the nuts and bolts of why why Country got bred a lot was number one, people was breeding to him that hunted with him, and they was bringing their good females to him and breeding to him. And there was a few of the blue tick guys that brought their good gyps bred to him because they hunted with him, and they liked what they seen. And a lot of your knowledgeable ones that understand, you know, I mean, when you stack them kind of females behind a pedigree, the chance of you having a reproducer is pretty good. And
I don't know how many times I've got phone calls from guys, you know, saying, hey, buddy of mine, Walker guy, hunted with him, you know, a couple weekends ago over in, you know, such and such, wherever, and said he really put on a good show. And I said, if you ever get a chance, you ought to try to catch up, you know, and hunt with him sometime. Try to see him go. And that's what I would tell them guys, you know. But that advertisement from outside people that had competed against him. And
well, the bottom line is when Ash Oxenstein bought him and I stayed on hunting him, and we got through the CHKC world that year, and Strickland had been blowing Ashley's phone up, and I didn't really want to let go of him. But, you know, it was after Wes and them guys had bred Ruby to him. And when Wes, you know, there's a lot of credit that goes to that cross being made is why Country got bred the way he did. But at that point in time, there was already pups, you know, the Matt Lingo's
club.
And Babe was, I was just starting to hunt her, and she was starting to win some, and Ellie was starting to win. And these was all out of his first litter. And when John bought, you know, and I have to give a shout out to John on one thing, as much as it pains me because he's my buddy. John has never studded a dog in his entire life and said he never would. And of course they hunted Country and had that big run, as most of you guys know or whatever. But you know, they was smart enough to understand the opportunity that was at hand of what he could do. And, you know, I firmly believe today the reason why he's bred as much is because them guys own him. I think that, you know, and he's been bred to a lot of really good females. And you know, the jury's still out on that side of it. But, I mean,
you better mention Terry Tappy when you mention Country Club, just so you know.
Yeah, I better would, because he'll call me up on it. But you know what, guys? We still don't know, you know, honestly, all of us still don't know what he's going to end up at on the reproducer. But I can tell you this, you know, based off of, you know, people don't realize, you know, today there's only 90% of his pups are 2 years old and younger. You know what I mean? Honestly, you know, I think Babe and them was the third or fourth cross that we made, and she's three, going to be four.
Yeah.
You know, and we didn't breed him a lot when we had him. You know, we bred him to Jerry. And you know what? And let's
I want to say probably maybe
we haven't 10, got time to talk about all that.
10 females, maybe.
Really,
maybe
we 12.
Don't.
No. Seriously.
We're going to have an episode two.
I don't know. This is like we're working on the first three-hour podcast I've ever produced.
Well, we can't do that. You have to break it down. But, yeah, so.
But let me tell you this. So the way I look at it, it's not people. I think people get caught up and they misunderstand that it's country with us. And yeah, it is, because we know what he's capable of. But I also tell people, don't pass up those other good dogs out there. You know, you got Danny Perez with Woodrow. You got John Steber with Lonesome 2. You got, you know, there's other stuff that Robert Shelton's got, and I'm sure Richie McDonald's sitting on something down there.
Brian Davis has got the Jessup dog.
Gary Uchman.
Yeah, we hunted with him at Blue Tick days.
Don't breed to them. But don't forget to bring something back. Because Country can contribute something to those breeding programs.
Kind of, you know, the point I was making earlier, you know, if you pay attention to these good crosses on him to use later on down the road to Woodrow or John Steber's dogs.
Absolutely.
Or,
hey,
whatever.
I want to share this. You know, I went out and hunted, you know, John, I went out and hunted with him three nights before the Super Stakes. And pleasure hunted with him three nights. Had an unbelievable time.
John must be a heck of a guy. I've never met him, but everybody says he's as good of a guy as there is.
And you know what? Them dogs, I tell you what they are. They are just good, solid coon treers.
Yep.
Every hunt that I had with them, they're just good. Lonesome 2 is as good of a solid coon treer. He's one of them dogs. You just unsnap him, and he just goes hunting. And, you know, maybe you're not your typical blow in there a mile, but you don't have to. He just hunts, and I'll tell you something else. Every one of his dogs, Lonesome 2, Slick, the Cash Dog, they handle like a dream. John never puts a lead on them dogs.
You can tell John's pretty passionate about his hounds. He spends a lot of time with him, and he's a hard hunter, you know, that just like Perez you mentioned.
Danny's
a coon hunter. He probably don't miss a lot of nights. I mean, those guys are just pure coon hunters.
Yeah, I have Woodrow here, and I saw the potential in that dog enough that – he hadn't even got a title on him, and I bred him to Jazz, you know, when I saw what he was capable of. Plus, there was a plan to bring that back around. But the thing of it is, all those dogs have something to bring to the table. So
let's, hey, you know,
nobody's sitting there sitting back here. None of us are going to say don't make those crosses.
Half brother Botox.
Yeah.
That's a good dog. Yeah, I hunted sure with him. Is. It's a coon treer. You know what I mean? And Terry Tappy, the little female he's hunting right now, is off of him. And Henry Blessing's little female. And that's a good little female, you know.
Yep. Guys, we could go on and on. I mean, this and I'm going to run it all as one podcast. I don't care. It's great. This is the kind of conversation that people need to hear, and I wish I could capture this every week when three guys sit down together that are as familiar and comfortable with each other. We can cut up on each other, we can have a good time together, and I don't regret a single second of anything we ever did together.
I don't either. I appreciate your guys's effort behind that dog, and I'm glad that you guys felt the same way about him that I did. It's that dog's meant a lot to everybody who has been associated with him and has experienced him. And I noticed in the podcast you did with John and Ashley, you could hear the emotion almost in John's voice when he's talking there at the end about after they got breeding him and he started hunting him a little bit and he wasn't quite right. And that's how much that dog has affected the people that's hunted him and has owned him and has been a part of him. And I hope people understand that that's how special he is to us. So,
well, one thing, I was a pleasure hunter long before I ever started competition hunting, and I'm 48 years old. Let's face it. I'm getting down toward the end of my competition career probably.
No, and, you got to wait till I at least get retired.
Which is
and
fine.
I can
I'll whoop up on
you.
I'll whoop up on you as well. But no, I'll say one thing. I would love to just share just a few minutes on coon hunting in general and the hunts and the camaraderie that's come with it. The winning is great. All of us. I mean, obviously, you show me a guy that doesn't care if he wins or not, I want to draw him every night. You know what I mean? That's just a competitive. That's just a competitive side of me. But what I will share with you is, at the end of the day, some of my best friends in this world I met through coon hunting, and country tied the three of us together, on a friendship that'll last the rest of our life.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing that some kind of give it a bad rap, but I honestly believe if you go into these hunts with a positive attitude and when you hunt these hunts, you go in there proactive instead of on the negative side or whatever, you're going to be on a lot more good hunts than you ever was bad, or maybe I'm just one of the fortunate ones. But when you continuously draw some of them top competitors and you have good hunts with them and you become, that friendship starts and stuff, if the competition hunts stopped today, I would still pleasure hunt, and I would still hunt with a lot of the guys that I hunt today, maybe even in competition, because of the friendships and the camaraderie and that side of it. As you get older, when I was younger, winning probably was a little bit more important, but as I get older, I look back at that part of this whole deal, and that's what I enjoy about it the most,
That's right. I agree with you 100%. There's been other people, and I think that's what people need to understand. Why are we so passionate about Big Country? Because it's not just about a dog. It's about the relationships we've built around the dog. And you can look back, Russ Downing and Perry Vesely, around what they've done through dogs. Anybody that knows anything about blue ticks knows that Russ and Perry are, they're going to take up for each other, because it's more than just about the dog. It's about the relationship they built around the dog.
I thought about that the other day when I was, kind of browsing through social media and come across a few comments and that, and sitting there thinking about the controversy that surrounded this dog. And I thought about Perry and Russ, and the controversy, with Spanky, and I thought, here we are, we're right there, in the same boat that them guys are in, and the same things that they had to listen
Man,
to and deal with Spanky.
But if he can
years.
Make an impact like Spanky did, then we did something.
Yeah, well, I agree.
Well, let me tell you, any winner of any kind in any sport or anything that you do, that's going to come with it.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to come with it. And You know, I remember Russ Beller, saying this many times. He said, if they're talking about you, don't matter if it's good and bad, they're worried about you. And you know, obviously, as you know, I mean, there's no guy that's owned any more world champions than him. And, when I grew up, when I first come into competition hunts, when Beller's name come up, it was always, that was always that mystique. But you know what? That comes with the territory.
And
you know what? At the end of the day, good dogs speak for themselves. You don't have to brag on them. You know, this social media platform, honestly, it's kind of...
Don't get off on social media. Be taking this on a tangent.
I'm not. But what I want to share with you is years ago, when a good dog was talked about, people went and seen it for themselves. And, with the way, people can get you can hear about a good one a whole lot quicker, but the jury's still out. But, when people that hunt with them, when they're the ones that are your jury, that's where the difference is.
Yeah, that's where it counts.
That's where it counts.